Okay, this is Occupied Territory with Mike Fader. Stay tuned.
Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, don't give up the fight.
And this is Occupied Territory with Mike Fader. We have a guest today, but before we start to talk to him, remember, if you want to get in touch with me, go to my website. It's FaderFiles, FederFiles.com, FederFiles.com. You can join my mailing list, and you can get in touch with me that way. Also, don't forget our parallel Facebook page to Occupied Territory. Actually, the show is called Occupied Territory America. Facebook page, Occupied Territory. And I post things there almost every day or every couple of days, issues that are in the news, essays I write about them, and then articles I might find interesting. And I invite everybody to go there if you're on Facebook and post things that you want to post or respond to articles or essays that I put in there. All right, today, this is, you know, about the Occupy movement originally and the show, although it's broadened out and down and up, but it's still basically about Occupy and about its major goals, about the theory and practice of it, and hopefully more the practice, because there's enough theory in the world already. Today we have with us Mitchell Cohn, who's the secretary of the WBAI local station board. WBAI is Pacifica's station, the Pacifica Foundation station in New York City. And he's an author of a new book that we're going to talk about called What is Direct Action? Lessons from and to Occupy Wall Street. And it has a preface by Richard Wolff, who is a famous economist, right?
Yeah. Yes, he is.
And what you would call, I suppose, if you want to use labels, a radical economist. In other words, that what that means is he's got his finger on the real pulse of things. So before we talk about the book, maybe we can get a little background on you.
Is it? Sure.
Yeah. Okay. So,
hey, welcome everybody. Let me say hello to your audience, Michael.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. Okay. So now I'm going to read off what you sent me as a bio here. So, Mitchell lives in the People's Republic of Brooklyn. Brooklyn considers itself a separate country and is an unofficial part of the United States. And he makes his living selling his poems in the subways and on Brooklyn streets. A hard sell, I guess. A hard way to make a living, I should say, right? Mitchell was the founder of the Red Balloon Collective at State University of New York in Stony Brook. Way back in the day, 1969, he has been arrested in the course of his activism. One thing for demanding freedom for political prisoners, Mumia Abu-Jamal and Leonard Peltier. And Mitchell also co-founded the No Spray Coalition Against Toxic Pesticides. And is New York State Against Genetic Engineering, is that a separate group?
Yeah, it's a separate group.
Okay, and he Mitchell was the chairman of the local board, BAI's local board, local station board, from 2008 to 2012, which requires a tremendous amount of dedication. It's impossible to describe what you have to do to be the chairman of the local BAI board. And one thing he did when he was there was fight to return Gary Null to BAI's airwaves. Mitchell also hosts an online radio show, Steal This Radio. And when is this on? How do people get it?
Well, now it's only on the internet.
Yeah.
And you could hear it. It's at nytalkradio.net.
NYTalkRadio.
Which is not currently broadcasting, but you could still hear the podcast up there.
Okay. And what's the website where people would go to get information about things you write and what you do?
They could go to my own website, MitchellCohn.org, one L in Mitchell.
Okay.
So two L's and you'll go somewhere else. To the head of the CDC, I think.
MitchellCohn.org. And also, obviously, as I mentioned, Mitchell is a poet. And you've got a couple of books of poetry. What are the books?
Yeah, I have One-Eyed Cat Takes Flight and The Permanent Carnival, both of which I've been selling on the streets in Brooklyn and also out in California when I'm out there and on the subways.
And So let's go back a bit. I mean, Mitchell is one of these rare birds that you don't see too much in the world anymore, in our world. He was an activist starting way back in the 60s and still is and was. In other words, he didn't take a break to go off and work for IBM. You know, he didn't do this, he didn't do that. He's stayed active all this time, which I'm sure has its ups and downs and its backs and forths. I mean, you know, you see triumphs, which we saw a few of in the 60s, major triumphs. Then you go through long fallow periods where it looks as if you're just spinning your wheels like a gerbil in a cage. And even as hard as you work, you don't see things getting any better. And then sometimes you see major reverses, but you keep doing it. So Mitchell's one of those, I would have to say, admirable characters in the world who has actually kept at this for decades now, when a lot of people just gave up or gave in.
Well, actually, most of the people that I know from my world back at Stony Brook and after have all stayed active in one way or another. A couple have totally sold out and gone to the dark side. But most of the people I know, you know, even despite jobs that they get or whatever, they still maintain a certain core values of fairness and justice. And
The values, yes, and I think a lot of us have. I know I have. And they just even get more. I was told when I got older I'd get more mellow, but it hasn't. No, it's turned the other way, actually. I get more, I don't know, when he's outrage is a little too over the top, but I'm more angry and more disturbed and more sad about events and more willing to try to do something about it, more extreme as I get older. But it's not the core values. I mean, it's even actually being out there doing it, you know, joining things, showing up on the street, getting in trouble for a good cause, that kind of thing. A lot of people sort of pull back from that because it's complicated. People have lives to lead. You know, they got married and had kids, they had to support them, that kind of thing. But it's a difficult thing to be out there doing. The book is, let me get to the book, which was published in just this past January?
February, actually, yeah.
February. It's called What is Direct Action? Lessons from and to Occupy Wall Street by Mitchell Cohn. And as I mentioned before, it's got a foreword by Richard Wolff. It's how is this published? This is a beautifully done book. I mean, the cover, the way it's printed, the way it's bound, everything about it.
Right. Well, it's basically self-published, although I work with other folks in my former collective, and we keep that going as a publishing sort of enterprise, Red Balloon Collective, but it's mostly self-published and self-distributed along with friends all over the place. Mm-hmm. So relying on people to take the initiative and get a copy.
Yeah, this book, also it has contributions from other writers. And
it has many contributions from Marina Citrin, who folks might know from Occupy Wall Street and also from the Occupy Wall Street Theoretical Journal, which is named Tidal. Isis Ferrell on the West Coast, Jay Moore up in Vermont, Arun Gupta, who is one of the founders of the Independent newspaper, Rebecca Salma, David Graeber, who just had a new book on the debt and what is debt. A whole history of that. Jeff Goldthorpe, John Tarleton, Sarah Jaffe, Dave Lipman, who you might he wrote a great song. You might know Dave Lipman as a singer songwriter satirist who often did his performances in the guise of George Shrubb back when as the singing CIA agent.
Vaguely familiar.
And he did a takeoff that I printed in the book along with many pictures from Occupy, takeoff on Sergeant Pepper. And the song would go, "Where Sergeant Pepper Spray and Heads Clubbed Band." And he has a whole theme of those in this book, which I really loved. So I appreciated that. And also Tom Angotti, Chris Williams, who's an ecologist and socialist. And the great Mickey Z.
Now, Mickey Z, I know because he's been on the show a couple of times.
Oh, okay.
Is he out in California?
No, he's here in New York.
But now, Mickey Z, is he in Brooklyn?
He's
right?
In Queens.
Queens
boy.
But Mickey Z has been, at least by phone, on the show a couple of times from articles that I read that he wrote on, I forget what it was now. It was like the people who were associated with Project Censored. He showed up on that same website where those people. So the book, you know, basically, I started the show in October of 2011, right around the time when things were getting pretty heated up down in Zuccotti Park, you know, when it was formed and it started to get heated up. And, of course, it's with the occupations vanishing physically, you know, or I should say most of them gone physically and morphed into other things. The show has changed a bit itself, so I'm not focusing on, when I first started, I would speak to people directly at occupations. You know, it was live from this place, whatever, Tampa, Albany, you know, all over England. So now that the occupations have been sort of invaded by the militarized police and Homeland Security and thrown off, you know, then we've sort of spread our wings here a little bit, and we're dealing with every issue. But one of the points here, and I'm sure you cover everything in this book, is that the idea of, you know, which we just went through an election last fall, and people were, you know, they were very concerned, Democrats or even liberals were concerned, well, we have to choose the lesser of two evils, you know, which Amy Goodman
the evil of two lessers.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, and I said, forget about that. That doesn't count anymore. And I was more in the attitude that Chris Hedges had, which is, you know, if you must vote, you know, for all the good it does, go vote for a third party and then get out on the street. So basically, I got a lot of tremendous amount of, you know, crap from people writing into me, angry at me, very angry that my kind of attitude, if it spreads, is going to help to elect the worst of the two evils. And I said, you're not even seeing the big picture anymore. It doesn't matter. And we have to get back to this kind of street kind of thing, which is a long way of asking, what happened between, let's say, the 60s, when everybody seemed to be able to get out on the street? What contributed to that gigantic activism, which was, you know, relentless and in people's faces, and I believe had an effect, to what's going on now, where only maybe if you took all the occupations together, you know, it was, I don't know, 10, 20,000 people at the most. Where are all the people who are being screwed by the government constantly? All you do is pick up the paper and see it yet again in another day. What happened to street-level activism?
Well, I think...
I'm sorry, long... You know.
Yeah, what was your question again? I actually think that there's so much activism going on that it's invisible, a lot of it, because the media doesn't cover it. But it takes so many different forms, some of which is visible, like Occupy, which captured the moment. Even though there have been occupations of sorts going on from the 60s and way before the 60s till now, but they're not in the media at all. But that caught a moment in time where people were looking for taking back the space, asking questions, not having rigid answers to the questions, but let's ask the questions and have let a million questions blossom and see how people respond. Working with the trade unions to some degree. I think part of what happened, I'm going to answer it in a long roundabout way also, is back in the 1930s, in 1935 and so, with the National Labor Relations Act, and the right to unionize was granted and other things, but it came with a price where unions, in order to be allowed to unionize, were not allowed to go outside of a certain narrow field of wages, fighting for wages, fighting for working conditions somewhat. But that's it. You weren't allowed to bring out social issues on the job.
Also, there were ways in which they were restricted from organizing that they hadn't been before.
Too. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And that was a compromise that they made in order to be legal unions. And so you don't see the General Electric workers at Schenectady, for instance, which is a huge plant there that poisoned the Hudson River for years with PCBs coming from that plant. Even though the workers were being affected by those PCBs because they live in those communities, they were not allowed through the union to raise the issue of what General Electric dumps in the Hudson River. Hmm. They weren't allowed to say, as part of our contract negotiations, we're going to stop the company or demand that the company not pollute the Hudson River, where we live and where our families are being poisoned when we get off work.
So generations later, because of the deal reached in the 30s, people have to pay the price for giving this up, right?
That's right. Yeah. And there was something that was gained, the right to unionize, but a huge amount was given up. And what's happened now with the right-wing assault, and I don't like using terms left or right that
I know,
indiscriminately,
it's
but
tricky,
it's clear that there's an assault going on the rights of people to organize, sending drones over people to spy on them or to assassinate them and so forth. This moment in time created, especially around Occupy, it was that moment that allowed the disruption of the whole social contract. It's been under attack, and part of the good side of it being under attack is that people are now saying, why aren't we raising these issues? Mm-hmm. Why aren't we doing these other things that have been outlawed before? And it's a battle within these movements for what to do and how to do it and what you're allowed to do under the law.
There was a problem with Occupy, I think, and the unions. It never got off to a it never wound up with a completely fond, total embrace, did it? I mean,
well, the transportation workers union came out in strong support of mm-hmm. Occupy here. That was beautiful. They defended Occupy when the first police attack came and to evict people in, what was that, November, I guess, mm-hmm. of 2011. And that really was a great thing. Imagine if the transportation workers, is something I brought up to some degree, started asking, how do we reconstruct a transportation system based on alternative energy that serves people's interests rather than the interests of the people with the money. And
well, the
start taking that on as a union with Occupy, with the Greens, with other people, environmental activists, with Gary Null, with yourself, yeah. with everybody. How do we rebuild different aspects of this society and see that as a legitimate thing to do through the organizations that we ourselves have built?
Well, I mean,
we had been banned from doing that.
But even this ban had to, it can't go so far as to completely eliminate free speech rights, right? Or maybe it just needs to be reinvented. I mean, that was a deal that was made a long time ago. Let's break it and
that's
start
right.
a new
well,
deal.
That's what's happening now yeah. is that the government itself is breaking that contract. And as a result, people are thrown into motion, turmoil, mm-hmm. not knowing where to turn. So there's that desperation part of it and despair part of it, but there's also the opportunity part of it. Mm-hmm. As we know, opportunity and crisis are two sides of the same coin in a way. So I think that Occupy across the country now is strongly engaged in fighting against mortgage foreclosures. I was part of about six different disruptions of court for foreclosure hearings mm-hmm. in which people just went, hundreds of people went in. We didn't hear about that in the newspapers, of course, because yeah, who owns the newspapers, right?
Yeah.
Mostly, for the most part. I don't want to reduce it to that, but that's part of it.
It's a pretty clear description.
Take over people's homes and that were foreclosed on, their farms. That's going on all over the country right now. That people is not in as big a way as it was in the 30s, and it needs to become that. But it's still happening. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole independent network. There's a working group, as they call it, in Occupy, that's doing that. There are other similar type of Occupy, the fracking, the pipelines
right.
that's going on all over.
Now, that I see every day because I get all these emails. I mean, you know, almost every single day somebody is like handcuffed them to themselves to a pipeline somewhere or stood in front of a bunch of construction guys who were trying to lay the pipeline. Other people have fought back literally almost like a populist thing from the 30s or before. They're actually fighting back on their farms in Texas or their ranches in Texas that people are trying to reclaim. This is all happening. I guess what you have to hope is that as it happens independently all over the country in different places, it kind of forms a larger breathing mass that becomes bigger and bigger all the time. Because a million individual, I don't know, maybe I don't want to get into theories here too much about revolution.
You said you didn't want to talk about theory.
But it's sometimes
you said there's too much theory in the world. Well, that's how you started the show.
Okay, I broke my own rule. It's like Walt Whitman, right? Did I contradict myself?
Yes, I contain multitudes.
All right, so there we are. So meanwhile, I had this trouble when I was doing, when I first started doing the show, and for several months there afterwards, in fact, you know, when the whole time that the sites, the camp, the occupations were physically there, I would get in touch and I would offer them a voice here, certainly a sympathetic voice to say the least, because I was completely in agreement with them. And I would either get no response or I would get, we're going to go before, you know, the working group, the media working group, and we'll get back to you. And maybe 8 times out of 10, they didn't, right? So I would have to just either go down there if it was New York City, or I would have to just persist and persist and persist. And finally, I would get this. And this is all part of the same question. I mean, I almost felt like I was a victim of horizontalization, you know,
right.
like a victim of kind of so little concentration and structure and so little direction that, in fact, they passed up an opportunity for media to actually help them out. And that's part of the original question, which is if people don't form some kind of united structure with all these different occupations everywhere on different issues, can it really get somewhere?
Yes, yes and no. Well, okay. that's a good answer, Zen Buddhist here.
Yeah.
It can, in that we can't dictate when those connections are going to be made.
Right.
Otherwise, you're asking for a line. You're asking for people to have a more hierarchical organization, which then you would have a whole other set of much more horrible concerns with, mm-hmm. right? A rigid structure and so forth. How does a movement find its own balance so that it can take advantage of the different things that are being offered to it? That's a question that's being fought out. I was in a lot of the General Assemblies where all sorts of things were proposed that I didn't quite agree with. I didn't really hate, but just little practical things. How do you deal with these things? How do you deal with, and then, rapes that were happening at Occupy? How do you deal with that and the sexism that was happening by some people in Occupy? And what happens when some of the women who were raped didn't want to turn to the police?
Right.
You know, on the one hand, I admire that a real lot, that keeping to your principles. On another, what do you do in the meantime? It's always the question, what do we do in the meantime? And it's called mean time, right, for mm-hmm. a reason. Actually, they came up over time with I thought was a very good response to it, which was they built these giant tents, which is why they were evicted, by the way, because they were succeeding. As long as everybody was sprawling all over the place and tents were being put up and everybody was being shipped here by the police department. Literally, they were told, homeless people were told to come here.
In many cities that happened, yeah.
And how do you deal? So that was allowed to continue by the police department and Bloomberg, the mayor of New York. But when people started getting organized and they built these large tents for women to live in together, and then had their own marshal, I guess it's called,
security,
or monitor, right, of women, then that became, all of a sudden, they had to crush that. You couldn't let people self-organize in a successful way. So the state had to come down on that.
Oh, so that's a really interesting observation. So one of the reasons why they finally did swoop down all over the country, and obviously in a very violent way, to make a point, was the fact that they saw it actually building itself into something real, a real organism that could actually thrive and succeed.
I believe that was part of it. Now, if you ask Mayor Bloomberg or any one individual, did you crack down at this point of time because the women were organizing strong way together? No, he would say, of course not. You're ridiculous. But if you look at the overall pattern that was happening everywhere in the country at that time, and they took different forms elsewhere, mm-hmm. people were really coming up with innovative ways of addressing problems that had perplexed activist movements and populist movements for years.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was crushed but it's still coming back in other ways. One of the, getting back to the pipeline thing, one of the, yeah. my most interesting stories, the one that I enjoyed the most, was seeing at a football game in Nebraska, which is football, if you remember. 100,000 people in the stadium decided to protest the pipeline, and they protested during the game. They stopped the game and they protested it. Everybody in the stands, because the pipeline was going to go through that area of Nebraska. Now, you didn't hear that was the reason why, or even that happened. But that's what actually convinced President Obama to pull it off the table for a couple of weeks while he rerouted it around Nebraska. So it didn't go through that area.
To see such middle America popular expression of anger about it, right? That really...
Right, that type of resistance with so many people who normally would not be active, you would think, although I think New Yorkers have a condescending attitude toward the rest of the country often, mm-hmm. because, I mean, it's exemplified by Woody Allen and many others, even though I love some of the stuff, mm-hmm. because people have a long history of organizing and farm labor parties and farmers in rural areas all over the country.
Coal miners.
Yeah.
So this brings up another question is the modern world so different that you can't succeed really without media coverage as compared to other times? So for instance, if you go back to the 60s or the 30s or even populist movements in the 1880s or, you know, all that kind of stuff, They didn't really have much media or hardly any media coverage then. On the other hand, media coverage wasn't such a big deal in some ways as it is now. It wasn't so omnipresent and so instant and so overwhelming. So those are like a two-part question. I mean, are we living in an age where if something isn't seen, it doesn't exist? Or is there something different now? Is there a requirement to use the media now that was never there before? Because there were successful, almost revolutions in this country before.
Yeah. Well, the Occupy folks certainly gave you one answer when you couldn't get them on your show.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
But that was one for side of it. Why should we use the man's media? But I think that would be wrong.
They threw everybody in the same basket.
Right.
You know.
Right. Yeah. I agree with that. I agree with you on that. Obviously, the media is so much more pervasive now, so much intense into everyday life that it's totally different.
Well, think about
that
score. When we were out there in the 60s, anti-war, civil rights, whatever else it was, there wasn't that much of a media there compared to now. There was no internet, right? There was only three major
TV. Well, we were complaining that the New York Times wouldn't cover our protests.
That's
true. That was the main thing over and over. Why aren't you covering? We used to have to fight to get coverage.
Right.
Now you have either that or you have commercialization of everything. So I'm surprised there aren't any. There probably will be. I shouldn't even say it. Occupy Frankfurters and Occupy, you know, somebody is going to just patent all that and put it out there for that.
Well, maybe
niche
Monsanto
market.
Will patent the gene that causes people to join Occupy movements, and then you won't be able to do it without getting a license from them, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So this is a serious question, but I bet if you would have asked movements in the 30s or back in the 1890s or so forth, there was always something happening then that was different from the time before.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be interesting to do a study on what it was that was different in each one and how did they respond to that difference. And the media today is a huge difference. But in my book, I go over the introduction to it, long into this 100-page introduction of which I try to cover what was happening all over the world, actually, not just in the U.S.
As far as Occupy.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
And in related issues. So in China, there were all these protests, but because protests were banned, they took a different form using the media. So people would say that the website owner would put out a call for people to show up at a certain time or place and just stroll with a baby carriage at this market and just come out for a stroll, no signs or anything. And then people, hundreds of people would come out and just walk around.
Mm-hmm.
And who are you going to get? Because there was no visible way of saying that they were part of a protest.
Right.
But then afterwards, the website would post, claim this as a victory. Hundreds of people turned out. So they used the media in that way, saying hundreds of people turned out for this protest against such and such policy in the government. And they claimed those people. And they did that under the name, I think it was the Jasmine Curtain. I have to look it up. I forget what they did it. But because it was happening all over the country, sometimes just separate things, they pulled it together using the media under this one rubric. So it made it, gave the appearance of a powerful movement.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, the government of China gave in to a lot of the demands that were being raised at the time, having to do with environmental questions and workers' rights. And it's very interesting. And that type of thing, different ways all over the world were going on. And I don't want to actually read on the air, and I go through about 8 or 9 different countries. A lot of these were compiled by a great website called Waging Nonviolence, which is put together by the War Resisters League or people associated with the War Resisters League and so forth. And just getting the information out about what was going on all over the world. And it's still going on today, and there's still protests in Egypt today, huge protests in Egypt against, you know, on the one hand, all these protests were taken advantage of, getting rid of Mubarak, and they were taken advantage of by the Muslim Brotherhood. And so now they have a religious, hardcore group running the country, and people are now protesting against that, the same people who protested against Mubarak. So
people looking for democracy, essentially, right? If you want to have some water, go right ahead. So, yeah.
Let me drink on the air here.
Yeah, there's no FCC in this world here. If you're just tuning in, we're listening to Mitchell Cohn, who's my guest here live in the studio, and he is the author of a new book, which is it's called What is Direct Action? Lessons from and to Occupy Wall Street. Well, since you asked the question here, what is direct action? Is that an old phrase that you're reviving, or what is that?
Well, I've been involved in direct action movements for a long time. In fact, they've been part of the history of this country for since its inception in some ways.
And in, well, the revolution itself was direct action.
Right. That's one form of direct action. And I try to go into some of that. What I'm trying to get to is how do you form through our own efforts that don't appeal to the government, don't beg the change in the wage, the minimum wage, another dollar so we could starve a little less slowly, stuff like that. And how do we build what we need as part of the demands that we make? So any demand that we make on the government or the corporations has to have a component of how do we begin building this ourselves, the alternative to it, and implementing it. So like one small example would be food, not bombs. For instance, they demand that the government, that people be fed and that nobody go hungry. And at the same time, they go out and they feed people all over the place.
So you don't do one or the other. It's
no.
You do demand that your government take the right action,
right.
But then you do it yourself too.
Yes,
okay.
You have to do that. If you don't do it yourself, you have no basis for exacting the change. There's no. So when we build our own institutions in order to, like for instance, Marcus Garvey talked about self-help a lot. Well, this direct action, self-help is a form of direct action, but it doesn't go far enough. It doesn't make the policy demand. It doesn't organize people to take on what's keeping them down. And think of all the things. So when we talk about ending foreclosure or stopping the bailout of the banks, we're also talking about give the money to the people and actually taking over those houses and opening them up. And this, we started this actually in the 70s with our collective against the budget cuts in New York. We used to remember when we used to go and we used to close things down. Shut it down was our demand. It was on our T-shirts. It was on our buttons. Shut it down. Columbia University, everywhere.
Oh, sure.
At some point, some of us decided that this was not making sense to a new generation of people and was unfairly or foolishly alienating people for no reason who should be on the same side. So we began doing the same actions, sit-ins, takeovers, but open it up. Mm-hmm. So under the budget cuts, I know at Stony Brook we started this, and then we traveled all over the state in 1975 and 76 when all these buildings were slated to be closed down.
Right.
We would organize takeovers to open them back up. It would look exactly the same. It would have people protesting, same. Looks, police come exactly the same. But what moral authority? You're not trying to keep people out. You're trying to let people in.
Mm-hmm.
And it created a very, very different feel to it and a very different politics.
So if, for instance, also as part of this, would this be part of the, like if you, for instance, protesting the way the banks have a stranglehold on everybody in this country and every institution and every structure, political structure, you basically remove your money from these banks and put them in credit unions or form your own credit union or form your own bank. In other words, that's the kind of thing you're talking about, right?
Yeah, that's one of the...
Move your money.
That's part of it. It's Ellen Brown is putting that out. She's
right.
Very good at that. And actually, Rick Wolf put that out the other night. And that's part of it. There are other parts, too. We'd have to think through. We'd have to brainstorm. The thing about Occupy that I loved is that you didn't have to have all these answers like you're just asking me. You could sit together with a group of people and just figure out, just brainstorm. What do we do? How do we do it? Some will be good ideas. Some will be rejected. But let's figure this out.
Well, this isn't a working group. It's just a discussion of Occupy. So,
yeah.
I mean, you know.
Yeah.
But people have done that. I mean, I see a trend towards that. When I look at everything that's going on, I see more and more people forming communities, small political structures. I mean, I've had people on here who have written books about the commons. You know,
right.
And retaking the commons, but that's not just the
who
physical.
Did you have on? Do you know? Did you have Sylvia Federici George Kafensis, who are the two best people on that
Dave,
on the commons?
His first name is Dave, and I forget his last name.
Okay.
Who organized a whole bunch of articles on retaking the commons? And the idea was he's got a website all about it. I think it's called some Reclaim the Commons or the Commons.org, something like that. And the idea was that you it's not just the physical commons, which is what Occupy was doing initially, or you know, for a while. It's the whole idea of the entire society we live in. It's the air, the water, you know. I mean, because the privatization is completely out of control, like cancer. I mean, T. Boone Pickens out in Texas with his oil money has bought up the water rights of about three different states. You know, I mean, privatization has gone nuts, just like cancer does in a body sometimes. And the reaction to that has to be to retake our air, our water, our banking transactions, the way our money is used, the radio, you know, everything.
Right. You know. And open it up, not close it down. And that's the connection to that. In New York City right now, all the public parks are being semi-privatized.
Right.
Right. We have all these conservancies. In fact, my friend Catherine Swan is writing a number of great pieces. She has a blog called Washington Square Park blog, and you could see, and Washington Square Park was the last remaining park in main part of Manhattan that hadn't had a conservancy or a private, so-called private public connection. Now they do, and that's there's going to be a big fight over that.
The excuse with this, at least our city government in New York, just using an example because people could listen to this anywhere, right? The excuse here was, and you see it all the time, is that the city said it couldn't afford to keep up the park anymore. So obviously the only answer was to get a lot of rich people and who made their usual demands. You know, then you have to kick those people out of the park. Then you have to wall off this part.
But why couldn't they keep up the park? That's the question. They cut the budget of the Parks Department 80% and more in the past 15 years.
So the only answer then is, oh, you have to go to John Rockefeller the Eighth, and he'll give you the money for it. But meanwhile,
right.
then you
and
can't.
And it has other, yeah, it has other implications as well. It right. means that there's no... not enough people to do the weeding that are being paid. So instead of hiring the people to pull out the weeds or cut them, they spray with the organophosphate chemicals that Monsanto makes and glyphosate and other thing Roundup in order to kill the weeds. And that poisons the people, which increases the health care, which increase, you know, there's all the health medical costs and so forth.
Well, I think all this privatization is really, it's not as if it's necessarily consciously arranged by some conspiracy group meeting somewhere all the time, although there are people who claim that. But I mean, it seems to work very well as an interlocking directorate of privatization.
But isn't that a conspiracy? Anytime a board of directors meets to sell us things we don't need or to plan out some policies, that's a conspiracy. It's just that we don't call it that because the media is part of a conspiracy.
But when you were talking
about, I don't talk about a conspiracy. It's a system. But
it is a systemic kind of conspiracy. If it's not necessarily an actual organized, here, meet me on Tuesday with the rest of the guys conspiracy. But it works that way, right? You were talking before about this kind of we were talking about retaking the commons. And the idea of Occupy Now is... you say it's sort of been, it's like a root fire, which it bursts up in different ways and comes out in different ways all the time. But so in the book, What is Direct Action? Lessons from and to Occupy Wall Street. And this is Mitchell Cohn we're talking to. That's 1L at the end of Mitchell. Give the website again where people can go.
Well, you could buy it directly if you want to get a copy of the book from lulu.com.
Lulu.com, okay.
Right, and you could just plug in my name or the title of the book and it'll come up.
Right.
Or you could write to me at mitchellcohen.com as well.
All right, so... Where does everything go from here? Is it you can't just sort of sit back and say, well, it will just spring up by itself and there will be a wonderful day of reckoning and I'll be so happy. I mean, what does a person do? You know, a lot of people who are listening here, they have jobs they have to go to. They have like maybe disabilities. They can't go down to an Occupy thing. They're working. You know how it is these days. People are working 1, 2, 3 jobs. That doesn't even buy enough even when you do it. Where do you find the time? I mean, in the 60s, a lot of us dropped out, or we were kids, or somehow we got by one way or another, or, you know, we had part-time jobs. It didn't seem to matter. We seemed to be able to turn out in the hundreds of thousands, you know, to fight this and to fight that. Now, I'm talking to people now. I don't know what the average age is. I mean, there are people, young people and older people listening here, but a lot of people tell me, they write emails to me and say, okay, so you're calling for this and you're calling for that. Meanwhile, who pays the rent? Who works to buy the food? You know, that kind of thing.
Exactly. That's a major difference as well as the media, is the people working 2 and 3 jobs if they have a job. And I know my daughter, who's now about to turn 24, has several jobs. She works. She's out in California. And it's amazing. I don't know. where she got this gene from to work as hard as she does and went to school and actually studied her behind off until she really did well and wanted to professionalize herself. And her values are okay. I like her values, mm-hmm. although I haven't tried to impose stuff on her. But I hate when people do that with people come up with little kids and say, chant this and chant that. And, although I did have her when she was... anyway, never mind.
Well,
skip that part.
But that's an imitation. You know, if they see it, they might imitate it. On the other hand, if they see it, they may go running in the opposite direction. We've all seen that happen.
Right, so, yeah. Exactly. And you can't predict that.
Yeah.
So, but she's working very hard, and all of her friends are working really hard, and they're not involved in any public
right.
movements. Yet when she came to New York, and I brought her down to Occupy right at the beginning, because it was all psyched, and it was, I remember it being a very rainy day, and it was, I just wanted to go home and get out of there. Mm-hmm. And she suddenly was totally fascinated, wanted to stay, and I was working. We were pulling in opposite directions. I wish I had acted differently at that point.
Oh,
there
wow.
are lots of things. Do you ever think that... I once asked Bernadine Dorn from the Weather Underground days what she would have done differently. This is years later.
Yeah.
You know, and she gave me an answer. She said, well, she would have treated the women's movement, liberation movement, much more seriously and brought that, tied it into SDS a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
But the second part was even more interesting to me. She said nobody had ever asked her that question before. And so now I always ask people, what would you do differently? Because I would have done a million things differently.
Yeah,
I can't stand these people who say, I would do everything the same. I would die with my boots on. And, you know.
That kind of rigidity goes across a political and any kind of spectrum you could think of. You know, I mean, people like that, you just can't deal with. I mean, yeah, what would I have done differently? Somewhere between most of it and everything. <You know?
laughs> That's how I feel.
Yeah, well, but, you know, that's how it is. That's the story of life, right? You know, and then, of course, without getting into too much of a deviation here, if you stumble upon the truth after seeking for it, or, you know, it comes to you in some revelation, and you're in your 50s or 60s, and then you want to share it with a younger generation, you get the same welcome response that we gave people.
And exactly. And I appreciate their response so
screw
much.
Off. You know?
Yeah. Who the hell are you to tell me?
I went down.
Stop telling me your stories already.
It's true. I went down to Occupy, actually, and there was a working group meeting there, and I, you know, I was standing, so I sort of joined in, right? And it was about media and press. And I, you know, I got my turn, whatever it was, and I said, you know, I actually have a show on the radio, and I'm completely sympathetic to the cause. I'm not connected to any major media group. Nobody owns it. It's just my show on a nonprofit station. And they said, you're part of the problem. Oh, okay. You know what I mean? So
really, most of the people that I know didn't say that at all. They treated me with disgusting respect. They kept saying, sir, or that. I said, when did I become a sir? This is ridiculous.
It happens at a certain point in your life.
But let me just get one more thing. My advice to older people, myself and older people who I can lecture to, because I feel okay lecturing to folks who are my age and older.
Yeah, that's fair.
Is that participate in the groups not by telling people what you think they should do, but by joining some of the actual doing, like help prepare the food, people help do the cleanup, help. They needed tons of people to help do sanitation, help participate in different ways in that and take part fully in the activities just in the mind.
Off the lecturing and back in the day and my wisdom this and my wisdom that. Just do it because it needs to be done.
Yeah, for instance, on the I was dissatisfied at some point that people were not seeing – dissatisfied is the wrong word. I wanted people to begin doing the mortgage, the anti-foreclosure movement.
Right.
That was part of what I was – and – I knew that if I just lectured people there, number one, it wouldn't work. And number two, I didn't want to relate that way to people because it would violate the whole spirit of what was going on there.
Mm-hmm.
So I just went every day and had my own flyers that I made up about this. What if we did this? What if we did that? A lot of what ifs. What do you think of this? And in an open way, and just handed out a few hundred flyers every day for about 3 or 4 weeks. And then lo and behold, at the end of a month or so, people had been doing that who had never read my flyers,
right.
And it somehow they were doing it on their own, which is great. And it showed me a couple of things. Number one, I liked my approach.
Uh-huh.
But number two, it showed that other people will come up with these ideas on their own as well if the circumstances cross, and you can help feed that. You could help develop that, but by participating, not by being an arrogant lecturer.
Yeah. Or even if you think you mean well, or if you've lived,
and there is no truth to tell people. You know what truth is there?
Right. Yeah. Well, no, only incidental to whatever the situation is. The truth changes all the time.
Right.
But one truth, actually, maybe there is one truth that doesn't change, which is...
That truth never changes.
Well...
the truth always changes.
But the truth is that without connection and cooperation, you get nowhere. Without connection and cooperation in any area. Like, for instance, it could happen in a marriage. It could happen in a working group. It can happen when a bunch of people are marching down the street without a deliberate connection. And without cooperation, this is what you get, a division sometimes almost psychologically. There are books.
And this is the part of you that I love, Michael, among other parts, that you bring in your history with psychology. And you were on the air for many, many years doing the psychology. Here's what I've been going through. And you're bringing that into social movements. You're making that connection between what's in one's head and what one goes through emotionally and what millions of other people are going through. Going through the same thing in their own way.
Well, the whole idea is that we're all in the same boat.
And just as messed up.
Well, sure. But, I mean, the idea is that this is where you see such a big difference. I mean, the tricky part is that you have to deal... One of the things you have to deal with if you're in the world we're in, sort of, you have to deal with the fact that you get this constant, to use an old 60s phrase, co-optation, which is clearly, if you're waking up at all, you can see that it's meaningless. But the idea, and I still have a lot of people who listen to me or go to this Facebook page, Occupy Territory. You know, hundreds of people go there, several hundred people a day. I get lots of angry people telling me that you can't just be a revolutionary all your life, and you can't just denounce both parties as exactly the same. There are differences. And they point out the Supreme Court choices or nominations. They point out that... You know, and then in the end, I keep thinking of things, you know, what people say is that the lesser of two evils winds up being inevitably
evil.
Evil. It meets at the same point where the greater of two evils is. They're going exactly to the same point. If you draw two lines on a piece of paper, that's where they're headed.
I think that's really part of an analysis that's lacking. I mean, it's an emotional feeling you want to have someone to believe in, someone to protect you, at least a little bit.
Yeah.
But the analysis is lacking, not seeing the Democrats as well as the Republicans, from my view, is part of different arms of the same corporate structure.
Well, look at this budget this man introduced just the other day. I mean...
They're arguing over whether they should bake or fry us.
Yeah.
You know, or how do you... They're going to cut Social Security. And here I am fighting for Social Security not to be cut, and I can't get Social Security because I didn't work on the books enough in my life. Right. Off the books, plenty, but, you know.
Well, that's a kind of altruism, too. I, you know, it's difficult. I don't know. It's a difficult time for people. Like, I see kids, you're talking about your daughter. My kids are, one of them is, going to be 28. The other one's going to be 33. And they're just trying. They're working really hard all the time, just trying to get by in the world. Yeah. They just don't seem to have, and they're very politically motivated, and they're certainly aware politically, right? I mean, they know what's right and what's wrong, and I don't mean right and left. They know what's right and wrong. But they don't seem to have the energy of the time, and certainly there's no place for them to generally to go. I don't really know how it works. Maybe the last question, we only have a few minutes left, is where do you see nonviolence in all this? And I know Chris Hedges got pretty upset along the way about people who call themselves anarchists, and I don't want to get into, you know, language here, but people who actually were throwing things or breaking windows or knocking things down. And there's the insistence on nonviolence versus other kinds of action.
Well, when I was in Seattle in 99, I was out there, and the first thing I saw were people supposedly in the black bloc that were supposedly anarchists trying to break the windows of this huge... This is before the whole thing started. It was like 2 days before.
Yeah.
Break the windows of this huge, mega, million, multi-million dollar store and so forth. And they took these huge bricks, and the bricks bounced back.
Sure.
And it didn't go through the window. And everybody went flying in all directions to get out of the way. So... if we're talking about what's in people's motivation, the frustration that leads to that, that's one thing. If we're talking about the reality that there aren't hardly any windows being broken, this is nonsense, that's something also. It depends what we're talking about. I disagree with Chris Hedges on that point, and there's actually a large piece that I wrote in that section of the book with other people's stuff as well that criticizes Chris Hedges for what he said about Occupy Oakland at the time.
Mm-hmm. Is there any place at all? I mean, I constantly look at Gandhi, right, from movements like this. Is there any? I mean, that's what you're talking about, mass civil disobedience. People suffered. They suffered in their bodies. You know, they were arrested. They were beat up. They were killed.
It's a very Christian thing, though. You know, it's I hate to say it. It's a whole Christian thing about martyrdom, of suffering. I am going to sacrifice myself for the greater good. Why should people have to do that? Why should we have to sacrifice ourselves? Why should people have to go to jail for their beliefs?
But isn't that the reality of things? Isn't that the reality of things? If you're going to sit in front of a plant that's protected by the police or the military,
you're right.
Then you're going to pay with your body, right?
Well, it depends on what you're trying to accomplish. I've certainly been involved in my share of nonviolent civil disobedience. I've been arrested like 50 or 60 times. You know, I try not to anymore. I try to just do stuff and get away with it. Mm-hmm. But yeah,
well,
so
I'm not
an advocate for violence. Mm-hmm. That's not where I'm coming from on this. Of course we want nonviolence. But the overwhelming violence of the states and of the corporate system, in some ways, making people hungry, making people homeless, that's not just a policy. That takes a huge amount of violence to throw people into those situations.
And they're doing it again with this budget. They'll take the food out of old people's mouths.
But it's not seen as violent. It's seen as policy, as business as usual. We need to redefine. And I respect Chris Hedges enormously. I think he's done some great, great stuff on this issue. I think he was very wrong. And he made that mistake because he was not part of the movement. And it's exactly what I was saying before. Mm-hmm. He needs to, and he was proud. He says that. I'm not proud of the movement. I'm taking critical distance, commenting on it.
I think sometimes he did show up at the White House gates and got himself arrested a couple of times.
But
all right,
we could have the discussion about Chris another time.
But the general principle.
He got involved in civil disobedience. Yeah. He got involved. He thought he didn't know what else he could possibly do.
Right.
So like many people, so he did that. And that's great that he did that. But it's not the only thing. And he's not aware of the other things that people are doing that are not being violent, but are not necessarily conforming to the form of nonviolence that has been socially approved of in the United States.
I'm just getting a sign. We got 3 minutes left. So
we have 3 minutes.
Well, instead of me asking another roundabout question, let me just reintroduce you. We're talking to Mitchell Cohen, 1L, Mitchell Cohen, C-O-H-E-N. New book, which you should all take a look at. It's called What is Direct Action? Lessons from and to Occupy Wall Street. In like a couple of minutes, did you want to, you know, sort of wind up making some sort of summary or recommendation?
Not really.
Nothing at all?
No, I'm just kidding.
But it really literally only got like 2 minutes ago.
Yeah. Well, I think that this is actually a very big issue on how do we not only rebuild our communities that we were talking about and create institutions of self-help while we're going to change the policies of the system that we live in and the country that we live in and the world.
Yeah.
It's so overwhelming, the world that's happening, the planet is being destroyed. How do we do that? But then how do we make those institutions larger and larger and connect them so that they become the new society in embryo? That's the key point, I think.
So that's a question you're asking.
Yes, it's a question. I have some ways in which people have done that. That was pointed in the book to explain some of the ways people have done that over time. Mm. But it is an open question. But people need to ask the question and haven't been asking it. We're always told, raise people's consciousness. What do? You raise consciousness. No. That's all nonsense. You know, you don't raise anybody else's consciousness. People raise their own consciousness.
But the questions constantly have to be, the question has to be asked all the time and constantly and re-asked all the
time. Right. It's always important to reinvent the wheel and to speak to the choir because new things come out every time you go around that wheel.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Mitchell Cohen, and it's What is Direct Action? Lessons from and to Occupy Wall Street. We will be back next week and probably we're going to talk about GMOs and how to organize around that. Okay, thanks.